Okay. So we are now getting coming towards right speech in the gradual training. But before I go on to that, I just want to say a little bit more about what we were talking about before, which is right action, the idea of abstaining and also supporting life, right? Being compassionate and avoiding killing or harming living beings, and also the idea of not stealing, the opposite of stealing being generous. Now, one of the things I didn't say, which I think is important, and I think it's important because it is a quite a common, I think, misunderstanding about karma and how karma actually works. And this is the idea that karma. People tend to think of karma either as good or bad, right? Either you do something bad or you do something good, as if there is no kind of nothing in between. Either what you do is really evil or is or is perfectly good. But the reality, of course, is that things aren't really like that in life. It's not either absolutely black and dark and terrible, or it's kind of the purest or pure kind of actions. A lot of the things we do are kind of in between, right? They don't really fit into those absolute categories. And I think the reason why we tend to think like that, again, is comes from the later literature in the Pali, which divides karma in this way, either between good or bad. It's either good or it's bad, and there's nothing in between. But in the suttas, what you actually find is, of course, this idea that there is karma, which is either completely bad, and when it means bad, it really means bad karma, or it's completely white. It means there's a karma that you make that takes you to the like the Brahma realms, right? Like the jhanas and the kind of metta, the Brahma viharas. It's a very, very pure karma. But in the suttas, you also have this idea of karma, which is both black and white, which leads to black and white results. And this black and white results is like being reborn in the human realm. This is black and white results. And in the human realm, you experience a mixture of happiness and suffering as a consequence. And it makes sense that it should be this way, because if you think about a thing like stealing, for example, there's many grades of stealing, right? There's stealing which is really coarse. There's stealing where you're just greedy. You want something more for yourself. You kind of cheat, and you steal because you are really, you just want more for yourself. And that obviously is really bad karma. It's coming from a very unwholesome motivation, unwholesome intentions, just greed for yourself. But then you can imagine being more like a Robin Hood character, right? You then steal from the rich, not so much because you want something for yourself, but you want to help somebody else. And even if you are Robin Hood, you can be Robin Hood in many different ways. You can be Robin Hood because you don't like the wealthy and you're going to give to the poor. Or you can be Robin Hood because actually you like the wealthy, but you have compassion for the poor, so you steal in that way. So again, there's lots of variations there. Or you can imagine yourself being a mother of a very sick child, and unless this child gets something to eat one way or another, it's going to die, right? So you steal something because there is no other opportunity for maybe saving this child. And then perhaps you steal with the intention of repaying it later on, right? You can see there's all these variations in stealing, and all of these things will affect the type of karma that you're actually making here. And it goes back to this idea, this basic idea, that is the motivation. What is it that motivates you? What is it that drives the action? And this is what in the end, decides the severity of the karma that you're making. There's whole grades of different things. So what we are trying to do on the Buddhist path is not so much to do either good or bad karma. What we're trying to do is to kind of shift from to lighter and lighter shades of gray, right? Ideally, we want to make good karma that is completely white and pure. But most of the time, it's impossible to do that. So most of the time, we have to contend ourselves with making karma which is as light gray as possible, as close to the white as possible. And we have to learn that. And it's the same with generosity. I'm just talking about stealing, but then you move on to generosity, right? You can be generous for a large amount of reasons. You can presumably even be generous for bad reasons. For example, you can be generous thinking, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to, you know, with this generosity, the good come, I'm going to get myself a nice new car in the future, or something like that. You can have a very unwholesome, not very unwholesome, but partially unwholesome idea behind the generosity. And the more there is of the kind of the greed for future results or unwholesome things underlying the goodness of your action, the less pure and white is that good karma. And again, but if you give purely because it feels good, it feels right, you give because it is, as it says in the sutta, as it is an ornament for the mind, it is a requisite to help you towards awakening. That is a very pure kind of giving. And that's why you're moving towards the kind of giving which is completely bright. So again, there's a vast range here, and we're trying to move towards that which is very bright and very pure as possible. That is a useful distinction to understand, because then we can have more basis for, you know, we have more of a ability to decide or to actually move in the right direction. There's no such thing as either right or wrong. There's this enormous span of gray areas in the idea of karma. So let us move on to speech. And of course, in speech, we find exactly the same thing. We find this vast range of things, from speech that is really bad to speech which is very, very pure. So the first aspect of speech here is lying, musavada. So abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. So here you can see it again. You see the idea. You don't lie, right? But not only don't you lie, but you are trustworthy and reliable. So it's not just that you don't lie in a technical sense, but your word can be trusted. It's, you know, sometimes people say, yeah, I didn't lie, but you're still slightly deceiving, right, by the way you speak and the roundabout manner in which you do things. But actually, no, you are very reliable, very open, very direct, very honest about things. So again, this is from lying all the way to speech, which is very reliable and trustworthy. There's a broad kind of category there of different types of speech. And again, with lying, there's no black and white, right? You can lie for many different reasons. You can lie, your intention in lying can be to hurt somebody. Your intention can certainly be to be greedy. Often the intention when people lie is to avoid punishment, right? You're afraid you're going to be punished, so you lie because of that. Or you can lie because you want to protect somebody. Maybe you think the truth is too hurtful or too painful, so you want to protect somebody. Now even that can be kind of a lot of varieties within that kind of category. So you want to protect somebody. Now, why do you really want to protect somebody? Is it based on wisdom? Is it based on a delusion? Is it based on self-interest? What actually is behind this? You can see it gets very complicated once you start looking at motivation and intention. But again, there is room there for massive variety in the idea of lying, from lying, which is not very bad, to lying, which is very, very bad. So please remember that, because it gives you more scope to understand how karma works. You really have to be aware of your own mind and to see what's going on to be able to understand what's happening here. Generally speaking, of course, one should always, I'm not saying that it's okay to lie, I'm just saying that there is a massive difference in the types of lying that you find. So you are no deceiver of the world, right? This is the lokassa visangvada, visangvadako. Visangvada means like leading the world astray through your words. It's interesting actually how the lying is described elsewhere in the sutta. Not here, but there are some other descriptions of lying. And the way lying there is described, it's said to be, if you are summoned to a courthouse and the courthouse tells you, okay, we want to hear the truth, nothing but the truth, the whole truth, etc. You know that standard kind of formula. And it's actually similar in the Pali to what we say these days. But then having kind of having obviously made an affirmation that you're going to speak the truth, still you knowingly, you know that what you're saying is wrong, right? Having seen A, you say the opposite, right? Having seen B, you say the opposite to what you have seen. And you do that, as it says in that sutta, for some trifling worldly end. You do it because you want to gain something for yourself, something silly, something, you know, not getting a bad reputation or what it is. So you can see that lying in this sense is a very coarse form of lying, right? You're specifically asked by a courthouse, by your relatives, did you see it? And you deny that you have seen what you actually have seen. So that is the standard description of this in the suttas. Okay, so let us go on to the next type of speech. Next one is a malicious speech. This is a pisuna vacha in Pali. So abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to those people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who unites those who are divided. He is a promoter of friendships, one who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. Okay, concord, the word here in Pali is samagga. It's like harmony, right? Concord here. So he is one who rejoices and delights in harmony. It's quite beautiful, isn't it? You rejoice in harmony, you delight in harmony. It's a kind of beautiful way of thinking about speech. So again, this malicious speech here is about saying things behind people's backs, right? Gossiping. And when you say things, often saying bad things, you're actually dividing people. That's the consequence of saying bad things. Especially sometimes you may have that intention. Sometimes you have that intention to actually deliberately say things you know is going to, you know, divide people apart. But often the intention may not be very explicit, but it's kind of, that's what kind of underlying the things that we say might be there. So this can be very coarse, but it can also be more refined. Sometimes you just feel like saying something bad because somebody is really kind of annoying or really difficult over a long period of time. So you say something bad, but even when you say something bad in a fairly innocuous way, just to get it off your chest or whatever, it often tends to lead to disharmony, right? And to lack of concord. And the opposite is the person that promotes friendships. This is the person who, in the world, you always look at the good side in people. You look at the good side, and then you, instead of saying something bad, you say something nice about them, even though you might find that they are difficult or whatever. You always try to look at the good side. And when you say something good about somebody else, then the other people think, yeah, maybe you have a point. Maybe there's something good there, right? And then you actually, it's a beautiful way of uniting people by always focusing on the good in things. And it's a wonderful thing to do because if we are trying to practice metta in life, if you're trying to get away from ill will, the first thing that we always have to do is to be able to see the good in other people. So if you're able to practice this kind of speech, whereby you say the good thing about other people, then you are actually learning to focus on the good aspects of others. This is actually a very good foundation stone for practicing metta later on, because you're training in seeing the things that are there, which are good. And then you are creating unity instead of dividing people apart. So again, of course, there is a vast variety there within all of these things, from the most pure and beautiful speech to the really bad stuff. Okay, then we have the harsh, abandoning the harsh speech. He abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear and lovable as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to many. So again, harsh speech is like, you know, really speech which is kind of painful or which is rough, lots of swearing and lots of, you know, speaking loudly and all these kind of things. And this is the opposite, the gentle speech, pleasing to the ear, kanna sukha. Sukha is happy, right? Happy, ear happiness, ear happy, is what that quite literally means. Lovable, pemaniya, as go to the heart, hadaya gamana, going to the heart. Courteous, desired by the many, agreeable to many. Very quite nice little sequence there of words and how one ideally should speak. Very high ideals to always speak like this, but it's great to have the ideal there, so you have something to aim for, right? Something you can always work towards. It's kind of gentle, beautiful speech, going to the heart. You know what that's like, right? Speech which goes to the heart. It feels good. You hear somebody speaking like that, it's like you feel relaxed in the company. You feel at ease. You feel like you feel good when you're there. And it's like giving people a gift, right? If people feel good in your company, if they feel happy when they're listening to you, if they feel at ease, it's like giving other people a gift, because it's a gift of kind of psychological well-being. And a lot of this is like that. It's like you're creating psychological well-being in the world by speaking in this way. And that is another way of just regarding it as a gift, an act of kindness. Then we have the last one, and again this is abandoning gossip, it says here. Not really gossip, I would say idle chatter. Gossip is more from one of the previous one, the malicious speech. Abandoning idle chatter, he abstains from idle chatter. He speaks at the right time, speak what is fact, speaks what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time he speaks such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So this is what the one that people often say, oh, it is so hard to talk like this. And of course it is. It is very hard to talk like this. It is very easy to talk too much, talk about things that don't really matter, right? Idle speech. But again, it's nice to have this ideal at the back of the mind. So you abstain from the idle chatter. And it's important here to know that this doesn't mean you should be impolite, right? You should never say anything kind of like the talk which, you know, we start a conversation with, we say something maybe, or how are you, and that sort of thing. That's not really idle chatter. That is necessary to kind of have a, you know, reasonable conversation. But what it means is that kind of all the other stuff that kind of comes beyond that. We have to have a reasonable level of politeness. But beyond that, you try to speak, you know, at the right time, right? When it is necessary, when other people are ready to listen to you. Not necessarily when you want to speak, but often when other people are ready to take the message. And so this is a very often, you know, often it is our need that we are expressing by talking. But if instead you can actually speak because it is the right time and people are ready, it is usually much more powerful and much more useful when you talk in that way. You speak what is fact, what is good, on the Dhamma and discipline, it says here. The word discipline is Vinaya. And the Vinaya in Pali, as I mentioned before, is actually related to a word which means training, really, in the Pali language. So I think it's better to say that this is speaking about the Dhamma and discipline, about the like the doctrine or the teaching and the training here, is a more useful way of looking at it. So the training is almost like theory and practice, right? The Dhamma is the theory here. There's a teaching given down by the Buddha. This is what you do. Whereas Vinaya is a practice. When it says discipline, it sounds like, you know, certain rules you have to keep and certain ways what you shouldn't be doing or whatever. But it's actually, Vinaya is much more than that. Vinaya is this idea of the whole training you're supposed to do. It includes the rules, but it's much more than that. It's the whole gradual training that we're talking about now is included in that. So you talk about these things because that is obviously useful. At the right time, you speak such words that are worth recording. And worth recording in the Pali is Nidanavati. Nidana is like a treasure. So they are like treasure, like words that are to be treasured, right? Words that you put aside and you treasure them. I'm sure you know what that means. Sometimes you hear things that are, you feel, wow, that's really beautiful, and you kind of remember it, like a verse from the Dhammapada or a saying by the Buddha, whatever it is, and you kind of remember that, and you think about that, and you can, you know, you kind of pull it out when it is a good time to remember these things. It is reasonable, it's connected with reason. It has a good foundation. It is moderate, in other words, it has an end, it's pariyantavatting. It is not a kind of speech which just goes on and on. And it is beneficial, is the last one here. This is one of the ways that the Buddha speaks elsewhere, is about, you know, the speech that you should say should always be beneficial. It should it should be at the right time, and it should be beneficial. This is one of the kind of basic ideas of right speech. Okay, so that is right speech for you, and again, it is it's very nice to reflect on this, because there's so many nice little things in there which kind of points you in the right direction. The idea of concord, harmony. The idea of speaking words that really are soft and beautiful is part of this. Okay, so then there is, I've left a few dots there, so there is a part that I have taken out, and that part which I have taken out is a bit more monastic in its character. So I left that out this time. And now we are kind of moving on into the territory, into slightly different territory. And the next paragraph here is on contentment with your requisites and contentment with anything. The point here is that once we're moving into the area of contentment, we're actually moving into the area of the mind. So far, we have been looking at right speech and or speech and bodily action, and now we're moving more into mental actions. Can also be considered livelihood as well, the idea of contentment here. But we're moving slightly in a slightly different area, moving more over into the mind, really. Another, maybe I should also mention perhaps as well, is that there is another set of factors in the suttas which describe morality. Morality is often defined according to these things called the 10 kusala kamapata. Kusala kamapata means like 10 ways of wholesome or unwholesome action. And that is divided into 3 ways of bodily action. We'll see now 10 courses, right? 4 ways of verbal action we have just seen. And then 3 ways of mental action, of mental ways of either being wholesome or unwholesome. So we've done the body, we've done the speech, and then there is the mind that is left. And the 3 ways of mental action, which is either good or bad, are basically desire, or covetousness is defined as in the suttas. So, you know, being greedy for things, ill will, and the last one is view. So having right view. These are the 3 kind of mental aspects of, if you like, right, of wholesome action in this sense. So we have already covered view in a way, because view is what happened at the very beginning, right? View was when you become a Buddhist, you decide, you listen to the Dhamma, you think it's great, and you kind of take on board that view. That is part of the idea of acquiring confidence, of faith in the Buddha. Part of that is acquiring right view, right? You're reflecting on this, and you take on board the teachings because you have confidence in those teachings. And then you have the three ways of action and the 4 ways of speech. So we've covered 8 of these 10 ways of wholesome action. There's only 2 things left, and that is desire and ill will, or craving and ill will are still remaining. So this is what we're coming to now. So once we have then covered also craving and ill will, we have actually covered all the 10 ways of wholesome or unwholesome action. Again, you can see how all of this overlaps. Okay, so let's see what the Buddha has to say about this idea of contentment. So, he becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it flies, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So, he becomes content, or rather he is content, with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomachs. So this is kind of the ideal monastic, right? The monastic, all you ever have is your robes and your alms bowl. And this is all that you carry with you. And then you set out with these, wherever you go in the world, this is all you have. Just like this is all you ever have with you. And the idea of contentment with that basically means that you don't really have much craving, right? You can see if you are content with something so simple, something so basic, just a set of robes and a bowl, it means you are putting away a very large part of what normally are the cravings of the world. All you have left is some very simple requisites. So this is what I mean by saying that we are here moving into the area of the mental world. We're putting aside all the or some of the mental defilements. That's what we're looking at here. This idea of being content with something very simple means that you have already put aside a large part of what we call the mental defilements. But not only do you put aside craving in this way, but you also put aside a very large part of the ill will defilement as well. Because craving and ill will are very closely related to each other. And I will show you some suttas about that later on. Very often, it is a very fact that we have own a lot of things, that we kind of, we have things that we don't want to share with others, that we are attached to stuff. This is mine, this is not yours. And all the craving and desires that kind of lie around this idea of ownership and having things is often what leads to conflict and problems in the world. There's a very close relationship there between desire and ill will. They often go together. As long as you have desire, you also tend to have ill will. They're part and parcel of the same thing very often. So by living this kind of life, by just being content with something very simple, it is a wonderful way of abandoning those defilements. And you still find, to this day, you still find monastics who live a life that is very close to this. And some of the Bodhinyana monastery is a forest monastery in a way, but there are monastics who live much more simply than we live at Bodhinyana monastery even. There are places, for example, in Sri Lanka, in the jungle in Sri Lanka, where you find monks to this day, both Sinhala monks and also Western monks, who live in little kutis in the jungle, like kilometers away from any habitation, any other human beings, right? And they live in this kuti, and then they go out for alms round in the morning, they collect the food in the nearest village. And some of these kutis are such that there's one kuti for each little village, right? So it's a few kilometers away. You go in and you collect your alms food in the morning. People give you the alms food, and then you go back. And that's the only contact you ever have with people. And then you live in this kuti, and some of these kutis are very beautiful. They're very... One of these monks, he had this idea that he wanted kutis that were like caves, right? So because the kuti is supposed to be like a cave, it only has three walls and then a roof to protect you from the rain. So you can imagine if you have a three-walled kuti. Actually, Venerable Sambodhi over here is one of those monks who are living in one of those kutis. that reminds me now. So, and they have like only three walls. So it's like at night or at the daytime, animals can come in, right? So sometimes you kind of get a snake coming into your kuti, or you get all kind of insects obviously coming into your kuti. All kind of things can happen. It's like you're part of nature, you're part of the world around you. And you have, of course, a very, very minimum amount of possessions when you live like that. It's very inspiring, isn't it, that it's possible to live like that. And it shows you, of course, that is one monk who's very famous in Sri Lanka who has lived like that for 40 years. And every year he will come out for 1 week to have like Dhamma discussions. Very highly respected, this monk. He will come out to have Dhamma discussion with other monks and perhaps with some lay people. Then he will have a discussion for 5 days or a week or whatever. And then he will kind of disappear back into the jungle, right? It's kind of inspiring, isn't it, when that happens? It's almost a bit romantic. But it shows you that, you know, there is a very high degree of contentment there, a very high degree of finding your happiness in something else than what most people normally find their happiness, to be able to live like that. So these are very good examples. So you do that, and so you are like a bird, right? It says here, and wherever the bird goes, it flies with its wings as its only burden. So the idea of the bird that flies with its wings as its only burden. There's not much burden left, right? You have to have your wings. Without your wings, you're not going to fly at all. But it's still like a slight burden. It's a bit like the monk who still carries the robe and the bowls. The robe and the bowl are still a bit of a burden because you have to carry them around. But they are a necessary burden. Once you're born, there's always going to be some burden. That's just the nature of life. Some burden will always be there. So you have these robes and thing to protect your body and maintain your stomach. And wherever you go, you only set out taking only these with him. And this is, sometimes when you think about this, it's a very beautiful thought to even reflect about this, the idea that people live in this way. And remember that what's going on here, these are people who find happiness in something else, right? Find happiness in some deeper sense of meaning in life. It's a very beautiful thing. This is what you might call the Sangha Nusati, when you reflect on those monastics to this day who still live in this way. And when you reflect about that, it should give you an uplift. It should give you an understanding that there is something more in this world. There's something more than the things that we normally see and we normally understand. And when you remember that, when you reflect on this, it gives you a sense of joy because this points you towards the essence of the Buddha's teachings, what these teachings are all about. And this is a way of doing Sangha Nusati. I might talk a bit more about that later on. So you set out taking only these things with him, and then possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So the aggregate of noble virtue, this is one of those strange ways of talking about, of translating the Pali words. The Pali word is sila kanda. Kanda is like the five khandas, right? A khanda is like an aggregate. It's like a sum of different elements and the sum of different parts all coming together. They make a heap, right? They make an aggregate. Just here means like a sum of things. So what this means is like possessing this sum or this various types of virtue, possessing all these various types of virtue. That's basically all it means. But it sounds a bit kind of strange when you use the word aggregate. When I think of the word aggregate, I think of a heap of sand or gravel or something. That's kind of my idea of aggregate. So this is kind of one of the problems of translation, is to make the Dhamma as easily accessible as you can and not getting into this kind of jargon or language which is not really easily accessible. And this is called noble virtue, right? This is Arya, I think the Pali word is here. Can't remember now. I think so. So you possess this, all these aspects of the noble virtue, and you experience, as a consequence, you experience within yourself the bliss of blamelessness, the bliss of being blameless, right? Because you have no blame, there is a happiness, there is a bliss that comes out of that. So what kind of bliss are we talking about here? And of course, the first part of this bliss is simply the bliss that you have nothing to feel upset about, nothing to reproach yourself for. There is the kind of the negative bliss of not feeling bad about things. And this is what we were talking about on the very first day, this idea of not regretting things, right? You don't feel bad about things. And that absence of suffering is itself a kind of happiness. Anavajja sukha is the Pali word. Anavajja means not having any faults, not being blamed by anything. So you have a happiness that comes from being not being blamed, not being at fault. So the very idea, this is how the Pali often works, the very idea that you don't feel suffering is itself a kind of happiness, right? You don't have that type of suffering. So that is a happiness in its own right. And then there is the positive happiness. And the positive happiness is just the joy that you feel when you when you think back that you've been doing what is right, you've been doing what is good. You have avoided the bad things, but you have done good things. And often when we think about our good actions in the past, often that can feel quite, you can feel a sense of gladness and even joy inside because of good things that you have done. I'm sure you all experienced that, that you feel that happiness because of the good things that you have done in the past. So these are the two aspects here of the bliss that is blameless, or the bliss of blamelessness. So that is the contentment with the robes. And not, remember this, again, this is very monastic, the way this is phrased, right? But this is obviously not only relevant for monastics, it's relevant for all kind of people. It's also in lay life. Are you content with what you have? Or are you striving for more? Do you always want more in your life? Or are you happy with this? You know, you've got a TV which is 2 years old and now you want a new one because the latest one on the market is much better than the old one. Or you want this, you want that. Or are you relatively content with the life that you have? And sometimes people, the big delusion in life is always this illusion that, if I get something more, I will become happy. That's what craving tells us. When I get something more, then happiness will arrive. But of course, what the Buddha is saying is not it's actually the other way around. It's if you are content, that is when you will be happy. Not when you want more, because wanting more just goes on and goes on. So remember that every time we always want something more. It's very hard to avoid that altogether. But look at what the craving says to you. Craving says, yeah, get this, and then you will feel content, right? That is the lie, the big lie of life. Then I will be happy. On the other hand, the Buddha says, and there's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada, which I always like to quote, and this the Buddha says that contentment is the highest wealth, right? Contentment is the highest wealth. As long as you're craving for more, you haven't got enough. It doesn't matter how much you have. If you crave for more, you haven't got enough. So you haven't yet got the highest wealth. But if you are content, at that point, you don't want any more. At that point, you have enough. You don't need any more. And so you have the highest wealth. That is the only way to reach happiness through possessions, is by being content with what you have. And it's beautiful, right? It's very nice. You're happy. You have enough. And you're satisfied with that. And that gives rise to a sense of peace in life. And that sense of peace you will carry on with you into meditation practice, etc., etc. So it's a very worthwhile, both for monastics and also for lay, for anyone really, to have the sense of contentment. Contentment with your possessions, with your relationships, with anything in life, to be happy with what you have. But whatever health you have, be happy with that. So not always striving for something more. Okay, so now that little aspect there, that is kind of perhaps right livelihood for a monastic, moving on here into the idea of right effort. So you can see how we're moving along in the Noble Eightfold Path. There's a direct parallelism here between the gradual training and the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, we have seen right action and right speech, and now we're moving into right effort. And just before I say more about right effort, because right effort is really the area that I want to concentrate on in this retreat, because this is perhaps the most difficult area and the most important area, and it is the area which has to do with meditation practice and leads on to meditation. So what I have done so far up to now is basically just a kind of preliminary starting point to get to the area which really is the most important aspect. And that is right effort. But still, just looking back at all these ideas that we're looking at so far with right speech and right action, there's a lot of aspects to this, right? I've been talking about this for quite a while now. And there's a lot of aspects to these things. So don't don't take these things lightly. These are very important parts. And the more solid you have in the foundation, in right action and the right speech, the more easy it is then to move on to right effort, the right effort of how to deal. Right effort has more to do with how to deal with the mind. And the previous ones are how to deal with the body and speech. The more you can purify that, and so, you know, put effort into that. Think about it, reflect on it. How can you change? Can you become even better than you are? I'm no doubt that everyone here are very good people, but even though we're already very good, there's always more, there's a little bit more we can do. How can we change a little bit more to move in the right direction? So remember that, because that foundation is going to be very powerful for the idea of right effort that we're getting into now. The more pure the initial aspects are, the easier it is to practice the later aspects. So always put most of the effort into the most basic things. Those basic things is what is going to sustain you, your meditation and everything else on the Buddhist path. Okay. So having looked at all that, now I want to go more into right effort. And this next paragraph here in the in this sutta, this paragraph is called paragraph on sense restraint. And this is a very rich paragraph. And how to actually do this is what this is going to be about. So I'll just read this out and then I'll discuss what is happening here. Okay, so on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. And then he goes on to say the same thing about the other five senses. The mind is one of the six senses in Buddhism. So I want to now discuss what is going on here. When you read this, it sounds a bit kind of, what on earth is going on here? This sounds a bit strange, but it's actually very simple. It's very easy to understand. It's just that the way it is expressed here, it sounds a bit kind of complicated, basically. So on seeing a form with the eye, a form is just anything you see through the eye, right? Anything. When, as soon as you open your eye, what you see is form. In Pali, this is called rupa. Rupa is what you, any kind of impression that comes through the eye. So when you see a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Sign here is nimitta in Pali, nimitta. And feature is, what is it, vyanjana. So signs and features. So a sign and feature here is just a sign. It's just an object usually. Maybe object is not the best translation, but I think in ordinary speech, that's what we would call an object usually. So you see something, you see a person, right? When you see a person, that is like the object of what you're looking at. So a lot of defilements arise in relation to people. So it's good to actually think about people. So you see a person, and now many different defilements can arise when you see a person, right? You like them, you dislike them, you fall in love with them. All of these things happen with people. You hate them, perhaps. So this is the first thing. Or it can be a feature, it can be an aspect of that person. You see their face, you see their hair, you see their hand, you see their foot, whatever it is. And the same kind of defilements can arise in regard to the aspects of the object. So the idea here is very simple. It's just that whenever you open your eyes, there's always a chance that you will be attracted or you will be repelled by something. There's all these things that come into our visual field. That's really all it means. So signs and features are all the aspects of what we see. And we don't grasp these things. What does it mean to grasp something that you see through the eye? And the idea here of grasping is, you can either see things and you can be like in a continuous flux. You see things and you're moving on, then you see the next thing, you see the next thing. But sometimes you see something you like. And when you see something you like, it reverberates in the mind. You remember it afterwards. You think, wow, that was very nice, a beautiful car or whatever you see on the road. And then it reflects in your mind, I wouldn't mind having a car like that. That would be cool to have that kind of sports car or whatever it is, right? So you think about this, it kind of clings, it sticks in the mind. And that is what is meant here by grasping. Or it sticks in a negative way. You see somebody you don't like, and then afterward think, oh, you know, oh, I really have all these negative feelings about this person. So again, it sticks in your mind. That is what sticking means. And if you don't grasp, that is when you get the fluidity of the mind. The mind just flows along. It doesn't stick anywhere. And this is what we're trying to do in meditation, right? When I say in the meditation practice, try to be the passive observer. It is precisely this thing that we're trying to do. You're trying to observe without actually sticking to any of the thoughts, sticking to any of the things happening, any of the things that you hear. But you flow along, right? You hear a sound. Sometimes it's easy to get upset to hear a sound. They shouldn't be doing that or whatever. But no, you don't think that. Instead, you flow along. You go along with things. Don't hold on to anything. You don't grasp the thoughts or anything that's happening. So this is what grasping means in this sense. So there's the difference between the flow and the holding on to stuff as you go along. So this is quite hard, right? This is quite difficult to get to this particular point. And then it says, since if you left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, evil, very bad, right? The Pali word is papa, and I think it's good to translate as bad rather than evil. Evil is a little bit, not quite right, and you will see that Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as bad in the latest translations. And states just means mental qualities, right? Whatever is happening in your mind, this is Dhamma. These are things in your mind, the qualities inside of you. So anything like, you know, anything like anger, especially anger and or ill will and desire. So all these bad qualities inside of you of covetousness and grief. And again, covetousness and grief is not a good translation. The Pali here is abhijja domanasa. And abhijja, it is true that in some contexts it means covetousness. And you know what the translators often try to do, they try to be consistent. And when you try to be consistent, sometimes the translations don't always come out that well. Because sometimes you need to interpret these things. And what abhijja really means here, it means like being attracted to something, right? Feeling attraction, feeling liking. You like something. That's really all it means. You get a desire for something. So desire, attraction, liking. This is what it actually means here. And grief, it doesn't mean grief. What it means, domanasa, is any kind of negative mind state. Feeling repelled or averse or something, a negative reaction to any kind of sensory object that comes your way. That's really what it means. Grief is way too strong a term. And grief is like, oh, I feel so terrible because my father has died, right? You feel grief in your heart. That's not what it means at all. So all it means is attraction and repulsion to the world of the senses, anything that comes in. And you can see that. You will notice that all throughout the day. It happens all the time. You get trapped by this. You see something. You hear something. You think of something, right? This is what happens in your meditation practice. You sit there nice and peacefully. Everything is going well. And suddenly a thought comes up. And you feel this ill will against, or get upset about something. Right? This happens to all of us. And then you get carried away by that ill will. And this is what this sense restraint is about, is to stop you from being carried away either in daily life, but especially in meditation practice. This is what it means. So I'm just trying to make this understandable, what is happening here. So these things invade you, right? They flow, quite literally, they flow into you or flow along inside of you. Kind of you awaken these latent defilements that are always latently there, but they don't show up until the right object arises. You see the right object or whatever. So to avoid that, you practice you guard the eye faculty. That's what it says here. If you leave it unguarded, these things happen. But you practice the guarding of the eye faculty. You practice the way of its restraint. So this, what this means, guarding the eye faculty, means that you are aware, right? You know what's happening. This is what mindfulness is all about. You have enough mindfulness to be able to see what is happening. And in daily life, it's incredibly hard because the amount of sense impressions we get are coming so fast. It's actually very hard to be able to guard this well enough. And you can actually start to understand how difficult it is. Just even when you meditate sometimes, it is very hard, right? Things happen so fast, before you know it, you get carried away by attraction and repulsion, by like and dislike. It happens so fast. But the idea is to try to establish mindfulness. The more mindfulness you have, the more ability you have to guard. It's the mindfulness, is the guard in the mind that tells you what is happening. That's what mindfulness is all about. So we want to strengthen the mindfulness to the point where we're able to have sense restraint. And you see this in the suttas. In the suttas, it's very fascinating how very often you find that the factors in one sutta, they have a certain sequence. In this sutta, you have sense restraint first, then you have mindfulness afterwards. In other suttas, you have mindfulness first, and sense restraint comes as a consequence. And the reason is because these things are interrelated with each other. You need a little bit of mindfulness to have sense restraint, but to have perfect mindfulness, the sense restraint has to be perfect as well. So they kind of build together, they build with each other. When mindfulness is perfect, sense restraint is perfect. When sense restraint is perfect, mindfulness is perfect. They are kind of two things that go together. So we have to kind of practice them together. And gradually, as we practice these things together, they all strengthen together at the same time. And even by just practicing the ordinary morality of body and speech, just by doing that, you're already practicing sense restraint to some extent, and you're certainly becoming more mindful as a consequence. So you are laying the conditions to be able to practice sense restraint later on. By being moral, mindfulness increases. When mindfulness increases, you're able to guard the mind more powerfully because you are alert, you are aware, you know what is going on. So this is the guarding. The guarding is the ability to see what is happening here. But guarding is not enough, right? Once you guard, you also have to restrain. It's not enough to guard and say, yeah, I see what's happening. Ajahn Brahm often has this very silly story that he says, you know, there's a someone has a guard at the house, some wealthy person have a guard at the house, and one day you're leaving your house and you tell your guard, okay, be very mindful, right? So nobody comes in and steals things in my house. The guard says, yeah, I've been to all these retreats, all this, so I know all about mindfulness, I promise to be mindful. Then you go and you come back, and of course, the robbers have been in. And you say to the guard, but what happened? You said you were going to be mindful. And you say, yeah, I saw the robbers coming, I saw them park the car, I saw them walk in, I saw them carrying all your goods away, right? So I was mindful. So this is the point here as well. It's not enough to be mindful. It's not just seeing anger rising, no. You actually have to do something about it. And this is the second part of this. This is the restrained part, right? How do we actually restrain ourselves? How do we stop the mind from having that anger arising? And this is one of the most interesting things, I think, in this whole thing, is about the idea of restraint. What does it mean? And normally, in the English language, when we talk about restraint, we think about it as physical force, right? You have a restraining order against somebody. And it means that the police comes and holds you, right? Okay, take you away. That's what it means, right? That's a restraining order. And there's a lot of force involved in that. But that is not really what is meant here. Sometimes it can maybe be a tiny bit of force. But what is so fascinating about this, what is really meant by restraint here, is actually being wise about these things. And this is what I said before, it is wisdom that makes these defilements disappear, makes them terminate, makes them obliterated, as it said in the previous sutta we were reading. And this is also, wisdom is also the thing that actually causes the restraint to happen. If you are wise, if you attend in the right way, if you're able to shift your attention in the right way, that is how, ideally, you stop the defilements from arising. So these are the two things. First, you are aware, and then you see, defilements are about to arise. And then when you see that the defilements are about to arise, you're able to shift your attention in such a way that you actually stop the defilements from arising. You see, desire is about to arise, and you know, okay, the reason desire is about to arise is because I'm looking at this object in a certain way. And then you know how to look at that object in a different way. And by quickly shifting your attention and looking at it in a different way, the defilement does not come up. You're about to get angry, and you know the anger arises because you're looking at that object in a certain way. By quickly shifting the attention and looking at the object differently, anger does not arise. And this is what I mean by wisdom. This is what I mean by wisdom. Maybe wisdom is not the best word, but I think this is an aspect of wisdom in Buddhism, this ability to know what you should look at. It's part of yoniso manasikara. Yoniso manasikara, the idea of wise attention, attending in a wise way to the world around you. This is what this is about. And this is what really is meant by restraint here, as far as I can see. And I will show you later on in the next sutta precisely why this is. So now you are starting to see what's happening here, right? What sense restraint is all about. Sense restraint is just about being aware. And then while you are being aware, you have enough mindfulness to see what is happening in your mind. And then you see that, okay, now a defilement is about to arise. Either desire, liking, or disliking, aversion. Desire or aversion. And because you see it is about to arise, you're quick to do something about it. You shift your attention quickly and you do something about the problem before it becomes too bad. Once the problem becomes very powerful, you can't do very much. Once you're really angry, it's very hard to get out of it. So you have to catch it early on. This is what sense restraint is about. So this is what this formula means, right? So hopefully that clarifies things a little bit for you. Explain a bit? Okay. I'll explain it this evening, okay? So if you can remind me this evening when at the question time, there will be Q&A. Okay, yeah. Okay. So that is the eye. And then it is the same for all the other senses. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, and also on cognizing something with the mind, right? Anything in the mind. In all of those cases, he does not grasp at the signs, and he does not grasp at the object. He does not grasp at the characteristics of that object, the minor points of that object. Because if you left the mind unguarded, then all these bad qualities, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would arise inside of you. And because of that, you practice its restraint. You practice the yoniso manasikara. You practice the wisdom. And you guard the mind faculty with mindfulness. And then you undertake the restraint by being wise about these things. So there you are. And this is how this works. And again, I want to point out, this is very, very useful in meditation practice, right? When you start off in meditation, you sit down, and then suddenly thoughts arise, which are not the right kind of thoughts. Thoughts of desire, thoughts of ill will. If you have enough awareness in your meditation, you can shift very quickly inside of you. You realize, okay, here I have to look at this thing differently. I have to do a bit of metta. I have to do something to get rid of this problem straight away. So in meditation is very useful, and it's also very useful in daily life. Both of those areas, this sense restraint is very powerful. But certainly on a retreat like this, it is very useful for meditation practice. And that is why the mind here is so important, that the mind is taken in as the last of the six faculties. And then, when you possess this noble restraint of the faculties, the arya, Indriya Sangvara is the restraint of the faculties. The Arya Indriya Sangvara, you experience within yourself the bliss that is unsullied. Right? Unsullied bliss. It is not mixed. It is not corrupted by desire and aversion. And this is why it is unsolid. Before we had the blameless bliss, but because there was perhaps a little bit of craving, a little bit of aversion and ill will left in the mind, it was like it's a bit solid. It's not really pure bliss yet. But as you go through this and you are able to avoid all this attraction and repulsion, all the desire and aversion, as you do that, the bliss becomes more pure. It's not solid. It's not mixed and corrupted with all these negative aspects of the mind. So that you experience this beautiful happiness inside of you. And of course, that happiness is greater than the previous one. What you are seeing here is this kind of, you're starting to see the path of happiness, right? How happiness is a result of doing what is right on this path. And this is what I was talking about the very first day when we did that Chaitanya Sutta, the sutta about how happiness is such an important part of meditation, how happiness is kind of almost the engine in meditation practice. It's the psychology of meditation. This is what you should experience inside of yourself. And here you can see it as well in the gradual training. It's exactly the same thing. These two are complementary. They overlap with each other. The same process that you are seeing. So again, this idea that this Dhamma is integrated. It's a whole. Every aspect refers back to another aspect somewhere else. So that is the restraint of the senses. For the next few days, I'm going to talk about just this. And I'm going to talk about different ways of dealing with ill will, of dealing with sensual pleasures. What are the ways of dealing with this? Hopefully, at the end of that, you will have some idea of how to deal with these things. So far, it's a bit theoretical, right? It sort of makes sense, but it's a bit theoretical. We need more meat on the bones to know exactly what to do, how to relate to these things. It's important that these sutta readings should be practical. They should be very useful. And this is what I want to do. But before that, I'm going to look at one more sutta, which lays perhaps a little bit, which is a little bit more theoretical. That's the two kinds of thoughts, and that is what I will be looking at tomorrow morning. And that also lays down, shows you in more detail that restraint is about wisdom. It's not about using force in the mind, and that is one reason why I find that sutta particularly powerful. But anyway, so that is that, and I will see you again this evening.